This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we talk with reporters here in Northwest Indiana about the stories they put out in print and online. And Deborah Laverty, who is a freelancer for the Times of Northwest Indiana, is with us today to talk about her stories. Deborah, thank you for joining us on the show.
You're very welcome.
Well, let's first talk about another county fair coming up. Last week, it was the LaPorte County Fair, which is the state's oldest county fair. And this week coming up, it's the Porter County Fair. Tell us about that.
Lots of excitement with these fairs. You know, they were forced to cancel last year, of course, with the COVID issues. So they're projecting, at least for the Porter County Fair, which starts Thursday, that they're going to have, you know, just more people than ever before. And they have a lot of, you know, fun attractions. All the, of course, for the food lovers, you know, they have all the food vendors. And they have some really good, I'm not a country music fan, but I guess these are some really hot entertainers that are going to be there. I think one of them is sold out already.
Wow.
Miranda Lambert's concert is sold out. So, so lots of, and of course all the free family fun activities. Trying to think of some of the highlights. And then the 4-H, you know, the 4-H kids.
Well, I know that's always the big thing, I know, is what the 4-H'ers get a chance to show off what they've done through the year. And I imagine this year is special because a lot of them have been stuck at home, basically, and maybe distance learning. But they've had a chance to do their projects and turn something in this year.
And they're even having the livestock, the auction. That's going to be held live and online as well. Last year they actually did online auction for the 4-H kids. So they were very creative, and you know, they even had some of their demonstrations and things online. So the kids weren't completely without, the 4-H kids, that is, weren't without their fair time. But this year it's full force, back to the real thing, you know. So it's got to be fun for the kids.
That's good to hear. How many youngsters are supposed to be showing up for the presentation of their projects and the exhibits this year?
Well, I was told by the fair manager, David Bagnall, that there's thousands.
Wow.
In fact, I actually called him back because I had written down when I did a phone interview, he said 1,000. I said, 1,000 4-H kids? He said, yeah, that's correct. So that's a lot of young people that are, you know, involved. And I'm a 4-H kid myself. I grew up on a farm, and it's a great program.
Mm-hmm.
Teaches you a lot of things, you know, that you can take on with your life. So,
now,
yeah.
You mentioned in your story about, of course, the fact that that food and farm animals and the like always are part of county fairs, and in this case, the Porter County Fair. And what do they have lined up on the menu, so to speak, in the midway for the fair this year?
Oh, you're talking about food?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I'm a little bit lax on that. I know it was Mr. K's Chuck Wagon.
Yeah.
With sirloin steaks. And the hot Wisconsin cheese.
Well,
I have not eaten either one, so I can't.
Well, we'll just have to check it out this year, I suppose, to be sure. So,
yeah.
And there, of course, besides the 4-H events, at least as far as the big animals are concerned, if you want to call it that, they have events including, I guess there's a 4-H dog obedience show this year. Can you tell us more about that?
That sounds really, again, it's the 4-H youngsters who are taking part of that, and they'll be, putting their dogs through the paces, and I'm sure there'll be, you know, competitions and ribbons and that type of thing. But, you know, everybody loves dogs. I mean, come on, you know, it'll be a fun thing to watch. And it's free, so you can't beat free.
That's true.
And a lot of the grants or the fair entrance, there's no fees if you go before noon, so something to keep note for families that are on a budget.
Now, if folks do want to show up for the events, especially in the evening, there is admission. Can you tell us how much that is? And what special days are coming up with the Porter County Fair this year?
Well, it's $8 admission, general admission. There's a senior program on July 28th, and senior citizen, and it's also for veterans, and that's a free day for them. And they're also having a special those with special needs and their chaperone can ride us select rides on that same day from 1 to 5. So, so they're
quite a bit
neat things.
We're talking with Deborah Laverty, who is a freelance reporter for The Times, about stories she has out in print and online. And one of the other stories comes a little closer to Lake County, or pretty close. It's Winfield, and we understand that there's a post office now available for folks who live in the Winfield area to be able to take care of their business.
It's been long awaited, and I happen to live in the Winfield area, so I know it's much appreciated. It's back and running, and it's actually 5 days a week. I think it's 8:30 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and then they have some Saturday morning hours from 9 to 12:30. We had a substation quite a few years ago, and it was in the one of our businesses, and they closed.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the CVS. Pharmacy bought out Fagan's, where this postal unit was located, and then CVS chose not to keep it. So it's been closed for several years.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, I think it was 2017. So, 4 years, and a lot of the local officials have been working hard to get it back. You know, there's a lot of red tape anytime the federal government is involved.
Yeah.
So, you have to give them some credit for, they had petition drives and all types of things. And people were really wanting, the closest post office to Winfield would be, people would either have to drive into Crown Point, which is a mess right now with all the road construction, or they could, drive to Maryville. So,
right.
It's a much needed facility.
Now, what do the Winfield Township people have to say about this? They certainly, along with other residents, I'm sure, have lobbied the U.S. Postal Service hard to get the substation reopened up in Winfield. What do the local government people say about it?
Well, they're delighted, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I have to give a shout-out to Winfield Township Trustee Paulette Schooner. I think she was the leading official in this. And she's the one that, set up the petition drive and sort of on the ground running person. So, I have to give her a lot of the credit for getting this going forward. And especially, during the holidays, there's different times when you, I don't know if what post office you go to, but I know during this last winter holiday, I remember standing in a line for something like 45 minutes, to mail a package. And so with the substation, people can, have a little bit more convenience.
That's good to hear. So the residents who live near Winfield or in Winfield, including the Lace of the Four Seasons, they'll all have a place fairly close by to be able to take care of the post business, to be sure.
Correct. That's right. Correct.
One of the other stories that you had out in print and online as well, Deborah, was talking about World Civility Day, the annual event. And tell us about this latest one that was celebrated this year.
Chuck Hughes is kind of the person behind this, and mm-hmm. He sets it up. He's a Gary Chamber of Commerce executive director, and he actually brought together several state Republicans and Democrats. And they were able to put their politics aside, and some were virtual speeches, but he did have several people in person. And like he said, he finally was able to put aside politics and actually come together for this World Civility Day.
Now
you
mentioned in your report about the fact that some people from Northwest Indiana, certainly speakers for the local event. Tell us what was talked about. Who are some of the speakers virtually as well as in person there at the Avalon Manor?
Let's see. We had, the Gary Mayor Jerome Prince was there. Of course, Chuck Hughes from the Gary Chamber of Commerce. We had a representative from the governor's office, Kara Hearing.
Mm-hmm.
She's the chief Equity, Inclusion, and Opportunity Official. That's a long title. Keynote speaker was Frank Mervan from Highland, or a Democrat from Highland, and let's see, we had Mike Braun, U.S. Senator Mike Braun, and we had U.S. Senator Todd Young. And those were both virtual greetings.
And I understand that that Helen Marie Harmon with Indiana University Northwest had quite a bit of speech for this event. Can you tell us more what she talked about?
They had workshops early in the morning, and those were over at the Dean and Barbara White Community Center.
Mm-hmm.
They called them civility workshops, and, you know, everybody had different topics. And hers was on incivility, and she talked about, she actually had a list of civility must-haves, and she unpacked those, and that was manners, understanding, strength, trust, heart, and awareness, vulnerability, and empathy. She got a very good response from her speech, and I think a lot of people appreciated what she was saying because, as you know, there's a lot of non-civility in the world right now.
Yes, unfortunately.
So, she was very interesting.
Well, Deborah, these are great stories that you've had a chance not only to work on for not only online, but for the print version of the Times. And we thank you very much for spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about them. And we hope to have you back again soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. July is the month when new laws take effect in Indiana. This month, several new laws have kicked in to help county prosecutors. The laws that close up the loopholes for drug dealers, new protections for statutes that some may want to topple, going after catalytic converter thieves and the buyers, and domestic abusers. But data is one of the big things that will allow prosecutors to go after digital data is being able to be solving crimes easier than in the past. Off-mic host Michael Puente spoke recently with Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter about all these bills, and here's his conversation.
The Senate and the House of Representatives passed a bill that essentially allows IPAC, that's Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association, to establish 10 high-tech crime units throughout the state. And it's controlled and operated by each elected prosecutor in those 10 locations. So what's going on now is they're taking applications, and each entity that or county that's interested in it is starting to put together a package, a proposal, so they could be one of the 10. Here in Lake County, we obviously think that we certainly deserve one of those units. And we've been in the process now of putting together a very detailed proposal asking for one of those units. Essentially, what those units will encompass, you're talking about $600,000 for 2 years to get it established, and then it's further funding down the line. But the first 2 years, the allocation is $600,000 for each unit. The unit consists of an association with one of the universities in your community. And in this case, we have came to an agreement as of yesterday with Purdue University. The chancellor there was very encouraged by the program. He thought it would be a great idea for his students as well as his university. And we equally feel the same way. They're going to be providing housing for us, office space, furniture, the phone system. They have a secured location that they're going to be able to put us in. So, because one of the things that the high-tech unit has to have, it has to be in a secure building with a lot of firewalls and protections and things of that nature. And they have an excellent location there waiting to be used. So we're going to just kind of step right into that. So that's going to help our proposal, I think, a great deal. But essentially what this high-tech crime unit will do is it will go to the crime scene of any type of crime that they think that they will be able to get computers, cell phones, cameras, any kind of technology device that could record something. This unit would go in, secure it, maintain it, analyze it, and have it prepared for the prosecutors to prosecute cases using that information. You know, one of the interesting things about the high-tech crime unit is this. just about every crime that is committed now, almost every crime, I don't care what it could be. It could be a child molesting. It could be auto theft. It could be murder. It could be rape. The person who is committing that crime has in their possession a cell phone. Nowadays, a cell phone is a computer. It's a camera. It encompasses everything. You can order anything off of a cell phone. You can communicate with a co-defendant or a cohort in an effort to in criminal enterprise. So we go in and grab the cell phones. We can get a whole history of what this person's been up to in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Who they communicated with. Who called into them, who they called into, who texted them, who sent them photographs or pictures. So it's just amazing now how cell phones in particular is playing a part in criminal prosecution.
Wow. Yeah, you know, this is one of the ways where sometimes technology can outpace the law and even government. But this is one of your efforts to try to catch up a little bit.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it, too. That's just how we see it, too.
Right. And do you still have to get on, like, in terms of, like, you're right, the cell phone. It's, you know, sometimes people, like, older people will say, well, you're always on your cell phone. But the cell phone isn't just a phone. It is a computer. It's a texting thing. You're looking up
Absolutely.
Everything. Do you Absolutely. Still have to get court orders to get things like Facebook interactions, Twitter, all these other different things?
Oh, yeah, this unit will specialize in that. We currently now do a large part of that. Our office is set up where we issue search warrants when police officers apprehend or take into possession evidence of this nature. And this unit that we're setting up will be automatic within them to be preparing search warrants and getting search warrants. Because many times after you take possession of some of this evidence, you have to still get a search warrant to go into it and analyze it, even though you got possession of it. So we go into a raid on a drug raid, and we grab computer cell phones, and we take them back to our office. We don't go into them at that point. We then get a search warrant to go in, indicating to the court we got reason to believe that criminal activity is on this cell phone, and it may help us in our investigation. So you're absolutely right. In every instance, a search warrant pretty much going to be necessary. Even if the suspect allow us to go into it, we recommend to police and investigators to go ahead and still get the search warrant.
You know, and it does seem like, I would say young people, but maybe even middle-aged people, they seem to like to document everything from what they're eating, but also a lot of them like to record things, personal things that they do. So like you mentioned,
yeah.
It could be child molestation. These people sometimes post it on things like Snapchat or Instagram,
yes.
and
yes.
they act like it's private, but it's public out there. Those are the type of things you try to go after, correct?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Particularly, you mentioned child molesting or some type of pornographic material dealing with juveniles or even or any kind of criminal activity like that. It's been proven, and we know that people who participate in this type of stuff, they like to look at those types of things and reserve them and maintain them. Then they'll go back and they get satisfaction out of possessing it, and also satisfaction out of sharing it or selling it to another person that want to look at it for that illegal purpose. So that material is on there to be preserved by them for their satisfaction. So that's something that we definitely want to be able to get into and analyze. You know, another part of the unit is, and is required too, in light of the fact that our investigators will be looking at cell phones with all this kind of illegal pornographic material, is that we are required to give counseling to every person who works within this unit, because what's going to happen with this unit, we're going to use college students too to do some of our analyzing. So if they're looking at things that nobody really want to ever look at, for the most part, you know, they need counseling for that, and they need some direction on that. So it would be built in our system too to provide counseling for all of our employees.
Well, let me ask you something, Bertie. And a lot of times young people who are thinking about going into college or doing some kind of technical background or job, they may not look at criminal justice as a route. But, you need some of those young people who know how to work. There's a new app that is coming out for everything, but you need people to know how to use this. Is this also a way to kind of recruit younger people to go into the profession?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, I talked to Pat Harrington, he's down in Lafayette, and they have a program similar to what the state is trying to do now. And he said that if you don't have anybody in there 28 and younger, you're in trouble. And that's true what you're saying. I mean, these young people, they know the technology. They grow with the technology. Now they're born with it. So you really have to look at them as being some of our future leaders and certainly future people who can take us in that direction.
All right, Bernie, we'll move on a little bit because there's another interesting law that has come into effect on July 1st, which is very interesting to me. And a lot of people might think, well, we've been hearing about this, but it's about the theft of catalytic converters, which has been something that has been going on for, it seems like, years. What is this new law that's going to give you sort of new tools to combat this?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is, they, as you mentioned, it's extremely expensive, very expensive, the catalytic converter itself, to buy, to rebuy. If it's stolen from a car owner, many times the insurance won't cover it, so they have to pay for it themselves. And it could be several thousand dollars with installation. Also, one of the things we know is when they steal the catalytic converters, now what they're using these skill saws and they battery-operated 18-24-volt batteries, and they just go up underneath the car, roll under there, and cut it out. And they ruin the whole muffler system, the whole exhaust system. So many times that entire system has to be replaced. So legislators understand that, and they're basically putting an additional sentencing range on these here. And they're making it where it could be a level 6 or level 5. A level 6 is kind of similar to old days of a Class D felony. Level 5 is probably like a Class C or B felony, whereas the jail time is increased drastically for that violation. In addition to it, they're making it the person who purchased it, the junkyard or whatever, they're increasing the penalty on that. So they're trying to put pressure on them not to be buying these from the individual, because if there's no purchaser, then there's no demand. There's no demand, then they're not going to be crawling underneath your car taking your catalytic converter because it has no value. But it has value, obviously, now because they can resell it on the market for a very good, a price. And it's very dangerous for the homeowner. It's very dangerous for the person who's removing it because, you know, we've had situations where people look out their window, saw somebody, I remember a case in particular, saw somebody trying to take the car basically, and he shot the assailant and killed him. So you know that's not good for society. It ended up being a 16-year-old kid trying to steal a car. So you know, taking these people catalytic converters and things of that nature certainly is a concern for all of us in our community.
You know, it is interesting that people are still trying to, because I've been hearing about thefts of catalytic converters, you know, for several decades now. And it's a very, maybe are unaware, but it's a very important part. It's legally required that you have one to reduce toxic emissions, pollutions, basically, from the environment.
That's correct. And when it's removed from your car, basically, you have to put another one back on there to stay within the legal guidelines. So it's not something that you can't, once that catalytic converter is taken off that car, you can't run that car. You can't operate that car. It's very loud. So you have to either bypass it and put another pipe in there, and that's illegal, or you have to go and purchase another one. And you have to, you know, here in Lake County, you have to pass the emission standards too. So no way you would pass the emission standards without a catalytic converter.
Not to digress too much, but there's a very interesting Hollywood blockbuster movie that just came out called No Sudden Move. It's with Brandon Fraser, Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro. That it talks about Matt Damon, Ray Liotta. It talks about the history of getting the catalytic converters into American cars and the fight that it took for the government to get them into the cars, because so many of the big three, the big automakers, were so much against it. So, for history buffs out there, you may want to go check out that movie.
Well, I'm certainly going to check it out, because I've heard of it. I haven't seen it, but I definitely want to see it.
Well, the last thing you would think, they could make a Hollywood blockbuster about catalytic converters, but they did it.
That's
so,
sure. Yeah.
So another thing that has come up, you know, certainly I've been trying to think of how to sort of tie this into Northwest Indiana, but one of them is SEA 187. It's about protecting monuments, memorials, and statues. You know, obviously this grew out of a lot of the social unrest we've had over the years over around the country, where people who are kind of socially conscious have been going after statues that they deem they don't like. Have you seen this as being much of an issue in Northwest Indiana?
Not to my knowledge. I know I've not had any problems with someone bringing it to me in terms of some kind of a criminal act or whatever the case may be. We've been very fortunate in Lake County with those types of riots and with those types of not having those kind of concerns of people coming due to unrest in the community. So we've been very fortunate in that regard. Now, I think in some of the southern parts of the state and other counties, some of those monuments are there, and many of the people in say more of the urban areas of those counties may protest to it. But here in Lake County, we've not had that problem thus far. But it is a concern throughout the state. That's why I think Indiana is picking up on it and certainly increasing the penalty for those and making it a felony. So normally it would be a misdemeanor, like a criminal mischief.
Right.
And now they're making it a felony to remove, and possibly a level 6 or level 5 felony if certain amount of property damage is done to the monument.
I'm sure the law doesn't apply to this, but I hope if somebody ever goes after the Howards and Sons cow in Munster, I hope they can
yeah.
apply the law to this.
Okay.
Yeah. Couple of other things that have come out, and it's probably a big one for you, Bernie, is sentencing as it relates to drug dealers, that it's closing a loophole that I guess drug users have been using for several years. Do you know anything about that one?
Yeah, I sure do, because I was on the committee, was kind of pushing that through through the state. And it was a concern to me because, you know, I'm a real big believer, and Mike, you know me over the years, in second chances. I promote that. I do it in our plea agreements. I try to get young people. I don't want to give a young person a felony conviction if we can avoid it. If there's no personal injury, there's no injury to the community, it's a theft or something that doesn't involve injury to a person or a human being in any capacity, you know, I'm always willing to give a second chance and say, hopefully this young man won't come back and learn his lesson with a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony. However, we have those who do get felony convictions and they continue to do criminal acts and they continue to come before the court. And for whatever reason, the court suspends their sentence and give them probation once again. And what this law basically says, if you're charged with a drug transaction and you plead guilty or you're found guilty and you get probation and you come back within 10 years, I think it is, but it's within the limit. Well, it'll probably follow, but our application would probably be within 10 years, but I think it's indefinite. But if you come back before the court and you get charged with the same offense again, this is for repeat offenders, then the judge has no option but to send you to the Department of Corrections and have to sentence you within that sentencing guideline, whatever the term of the sentence of that charge is. But the judge cannot give you probation, cannot send you to work release, cannot give you alternative sentencing. And what we're trying to be is send the message that once is enough. Twice is obviously too many, and certainly the third time you should be going to jail. In this change, the second time you will be going to jail on a conviction.
All right, and probably the last one is SEA 79. It's about protective orders and domestic battery. How does this apply now? How this new law can it be applied?
Well, you know what we're looking at is that particular section. Is dealing with strangulation and causing for a stiffer penalty when a person engaged in domestic batteries and a subsequent domestic battery, kind of equal to the drug type thing, where a person is given probation or whatever prohibits them from not doing some type of jail time for that violation. As far as the protective order, It gives the court the right to do it automatic. And many times when a person comes in, we do a protective order on that person, knowing that they may have a propensity to do domestic violence, and that kind of protects the victim from any future actions. If the person comes back toward them, then we can make an arrest without actually filing charges for the second offense.
We're talking to Bernard Carter, longtime prosecutor for Lake County, Indiana, about the new laws that have gone into effect this month that aids in criminal prosecutions. Bernie, I do have to ask you about a high-profile police-involved shooting out of Gary back in November 2019. A Gary police officer responded to a report of an intoxicated man with a weapon at an apartment on Roosevelt Street in Gary. Investigators said they found 82-year-old Melvin Bowler with a gun. He was also intoxicated and threatened to use the gun to harm himself and others. The officer from Gary responded, said Bowler was sitting in a car outside the complex when he pulled out a silver revolver from his right pocket and pointed it at the officer. The officer fired. Bowler was struck several times and critically wounded. Authorities said they recovered a loaded weapon from inside his red Nissan Altima. He died 2 months later. And just yesterday, a grand jury decided not to bring criminal charges against the officer. Prosecutor Bernard Carter, what can you tell us about that decision?
Yeah, I can say this, and I can say what I said at the press conference. Okay. I'm prohibited by state statute. It's 3534-10-2 that says that essentially that it's improper for a prosecutor to speak on testimonial evidence in a grand jury setting. So what we did a press release, and we allowed the sheriff to send to read a 15-page summary of their investigation as to this crime or alleged act.
All right.
At the press conference, I announced that the grand jury today, approximately 10 a.m., returned a no indictment verdict. So essentially, they did not bring any charges against this police officer. We had submitted charges for murder, and we submitted charges for reckless homicide to the grand jury. And in that return, they found no evidence to amount to that. And I announced that this morning.
All right. And this isn't something where you would charge Gary Police Officer Brandon Henderson on your own?
That's correct. Well, it went to a grand jury. So once it goes to a grand jury, then they hear the evidence and they make that decision. I had the right as a prosecutor not to take it to a grand jury and make that decision myself through my office. But we decided based on the evidence and based on what was presented, we wanted a full view heard by an entity such as a grand jury and let them make a determination.
Well, Bernie, let me ask you this. Just in a broader sense, we've been, you know, obviously we hear a lot about police-involved shootings, especially when it comes to African-Americans. This is something that it people sometimes will, like, think that, you know, prosecutors and police are on the same side, but you are also there to protect the public, and you're also African-American. Do you feel generally that the courts give or the police let me ask you this. How do you feel in terms of overall, can African-Americans and minorities, is there enough justice in the justice system for people of color?
Well, that's a tough question, and it's a difficult question in light of the fact that it's been going on across our country. And you'd be blind, or I would be blind not to say that that there's a problem there, and there is a problem there. But one of the things I clearly know is that in policing, you have some very good police officers, and police officers who go on duty to do the public's work. They're there and to protect us. You do have those who don't have the public interest in mind, and they out of control. Those individuals, one, should not be on the police force. Two, if they are alleged to have committed some act like that or did something like that, they should be charged, criminally charged. They should be fired, and they certainly should be prosecuted, and they should be incarcerated. I'm very strong on that issue. I also understand that the public don't trust the relationship between the prosecutor in a local jurisdiction and the police department in the same jurisdiction that they work with every day. And that's a problem. And I'm working with Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association. I'm on one of the committees that's taking a real hard look at, and we're going to do something about this, where if a homicide or a shooting occurs where a police officer is involved and it results in a death, that case automatically is shifted to the state police for investigation. Secondly, it's shifted to a outside prosecutor coming in to review that case. The local prosecutor would not have any jurisdiction over that case. It would be taken, given by a local outside prosecutor to come in and prosecute that case, similar to what they did up in Minnesota. Now, I think that's very important because the nexus between a local prosecutor and the current police departments in that jurisdiction is a very close nexus. But I do know prosecutors take their job very seriously, and they will prosecute, such as myself. I will prosecute a police officer. I have prosecuted, 50, 60 police officers for various criminal activities over the years. None for a police-related shooting, however, but certainly for any other kind of criminal offense that you can name almost, we prosecuted police. So I'm a strong believer that no one is above the law. No one can do things that is interpreted as being improper or illegal, and in my opinion, get away with it when one can easily see that this activity is going on. So clearly, if someone is doing something that is illegal and they happen to be a police officer, that individual should be prosecuted for that act. And that includes a police-related shooting, if, in fact, it was an unjustified shooting. And that's the issue right there, is the act that the police officer is doing is justified. If it is, then we have to, as a community and as a public, have to protect that officer. If the officer stretches outside of that and does something that is resulted as to just outright murder, then he should be prosecuted, or she should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Bernie Carter, prosecutor, Lake County, Indiana. Bernie, thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll have a conversation with a Maryville businessman who did some good deeds by making pizzas. This is Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Back after the tornado, a stranger came to town with a red pickup, a wood-fired oven, and a message of hope. Free hand-tossed pizzas for everyone. Brian Brock is the fellow we're talking about from Maryville, and he's with us today to tell us more about his mission, I suppose, to help people that need some help, especially after a natural disaster like all of the tornadoes that came through, in particular over in Chicagoland, but here in Northwest Indiana. And Brian, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about yourself, about your experiences, and your involvement with your own business that you started up that got you started in a way to help people when they have had problems of their own to deal with, like a loss of a home or worse.
My background, I come from a military background. I was in the Army for 3 years, and that taught me a lot about life and about helping others and selfless service, and set me up on the right path, I guess. And I started up a company in 2020 called Elevated Pie Company. We're a mobile wood fire pizzeria. And I started that company with a mission to help others in times of need. It's really nice that I have a skill. I can make food. And sometimes after storms, people don't have power, water, gas. They have no way to eat for sometimes weeks on end. So I'm able to go out there and serve up some free pizzas to those in need. All of our profits we make from local markets that we do go back into this type of mission, to feeding those in times of need. So it's really a good way to be able to give back and help people out.
I know you like to call your venture Operation Pizza Front, and that certainly shows with your military background, the time of service that you spent overseas fighting the war. And I guess this, too, is a way to help yourself deal with some of the stress that you faced and in turn probably still face every day. I guess it's a way to kind of shunt it off for another time.
That's correct. It's really nice just to be able to get out there and get in the focus, get in the groove of making some pizza, and really gets my mind off of things. And it's just a nice de-stressor. You would think it's stressful. You know, when I work these markets, I'm actually pretty stressed. Cause I'm there having to make a quota to make my money for the day. But when I'm able to go out and get back, I'm not worried about making anything. I'm able to sit there and actually do it alone. I'm able to get about 100 pizzas out a day by myself. And it just really it's a de-stressor for me. It's nice to get out and talk to people and hear their stories and share my stories with them.
And I know that you easily admit the fact that you have PTSD because of your time in Afghanistan. And you mentioned, I know that it's a way to help deal with it, that it's kind of been your medicine, I suppose, in a way, making pizza. And in particular, for people that are probably going through the same stresses because of a disaster at home that you had to face overseas.
That's correct. Yeah, it's you know, people after these storms, they're going through it too. They have a lot going on. They got insurance agents over there. There's a lot going on the first 72 hours after a disaster, and I think this is a good way just to calm them down too. They don't have to think about anything. They can just go and eat. So it's really nice all the way around. We can share some of the same stresses.
Now, when you have this opportunity to be able to help people out in a natural disaster, how do you make up for it in your business to be able to help take care of some of the costs of the extra dough and the extra effort that you have to make?
Well, usually we were taking the money that we were making from the markets.
Yeah.
And that actually ran up pretty quick. We don't work that many markets. It just started for the season. But people have been asking how to donate, and people have been donating, and I've made, I think, almost $4,000 so far, and that's enough to get out and make another almost 1,000 pizzas.
Wow.
So I'll be able to follow, I'm going to keep feeding Naperville as they need it, feed around here, and then say a hurricane hits somewhere pretty bad. I think I'm going to head down there and set up for a week or so and just do what I can to help. It's nice to be able to help, and I think I want to follow the storms and be able to do this full time. It's a lot. It's a really self-fulfilling project I got going on.
Now, Brian, I understand that one of the most recent opportunities you had to help people out was over in Darien after the tornado moved through over in Illinois. How did you first get word about this and get some tips from the authorities as to where to go to be able to set up shop, so to speak, and help people?
I actually saw the story on the morning news on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had some of our own tornado warnings out here, and so we were kind of on edge thinking what could happen, and woke up in the morning and saw how devastated some of the neighborhoods over in Darien were. And so I had some dough already to go, and I decided to take it out there and just go out there. The way I found it was actually just drove out to the town, and I was just driving, and I stopped at the first neighborhood I saw that looked like they were hit pretty hard. It was a lot of the street was closed off. There was a lot of workers out there working on the power lines, working on everything. And I talked to some of the neighbors, and they had no power, no water, no gas, no anything. So they had no way to even eat. So I just knew that they needed to be served.
What did you do? Just set up shop there, I suppose. Pitch a tent, bring the truck out there, and get the wood-fired oven going.
Exactly. I actually have to wake up a few hours early to start the oven. It closes up, and so I just put the fire out when I drive, but it retains most of the heat. It takes about 3 hours to get up to 900 degrees.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I just drove out there. I serve underneath a tent, got a little screen around it, and I'm able just to sit out there, and, I can set up anywhere. So it's a really cool thing.
Now, what kind of reaction did you get from folks that had a chance to have some pizza that might have been maybe the first meal in hours, maybe even longer, because of the damage at their homes?
Yeah, a lot of people really loved the pizza. They were just happy that someone came to bring them some food. A lot of people had no idea how they were going to eat, and I think it helped them, being able to sit there and get a free meal and not have to worry about where the meal's coming from or how they're going to get it.
So you're just keeping an eye on the weather, eye on the sky, as the meteorologists have to see where the next storms are going to be, and you'll be headed that way if they come up again?
100%. That's my mission, and that's what I really enjoy doing, and I think I'll keep doing it.
Brian Rock is a gentleman who has a mission and a vision that he wants to help make pizzas for people in natural disaster sites. And he's from Merrillville, and he takes his skills and talents over into Illinois as they show up in the weather. And we appreciate you spending time talking about it with us today.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Times reporter Deborah Laverty, to Michael Puente for his conversation with Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter, and our conversation with Brian Rock. And we hope you'll join us on Monday.